From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Flint Congressman Dan Kildee on Clinton versus Trump.
We are called to the offices we hold, not to pander to the worst instincts of people, but to try to elevate people to get beyond their fear, to get beyond their anger, and to try to create a path forward.
The rise and fall of Ypsilanti car creator Preston Tucker.
He actually was honestly trying to build a car. He was trying to start a car company, and he got shot down by government regulators, which, of course, is a story as old as government.
Going for a Guinness record, doing push-ups for 8 hours?
It's like the halfway point for someone in a marathon. They talk about hitting that wall. Your body just starts saying, you need to stop.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the story of Ypsilanti's Preston Tucker, the entrepreneur who hoped to give post-war America the car of the future, and how his dream was squashed by the federal government. That's later in the program. But first, Hillary Clinton steps to the podium tonight in Philadelphia to accept the Democratic Party nomination for president, the finale of an historic week and sometimes raucous week as supporters of Bernie Sanders vent their disappointment and at times rage. Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint is with us now from Philadelphia. And Congressman, I saw you standing there at Senator Debbie Stabenow's side as she announced Michigan's vote during the roll call on Tuesday night. What were your thoughts as you watched Hillary Clinton's nomination become reality?
Well, interesting. It was a great moment. And my thoughts were far less about politics. I thought about my mom, who has lived long enough to see a woman nominated for president, my daughter, who will cast a vote for a woman as president, and my 5-year-old granddaughter, who will now grow up in a country where that glass ceiling has been broken. And it was honestly much more of a personal sense of gratitude and joy that I had than anything political.
There were some very, very powerful speeches last night with, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, former Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and Vice President Biden, President Obama. Whose speech won the night for you?
Well, I think President Obama, because of the fact that this is his last address to the convention as President of the United States, really captured not only the moment, but actually captured the message. It was a great speech. You know, he's obviously a skilled orator. But the substance of that presentation, I think, left a lot of people really, really moved. And, you know, the focus that he brought to what the real question is going forward, a person who has occupied the Oval Office for 7.5 years knows more than anybody else what it takes to do that job. And his observations about the choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I think, were very important. And of course, it was in some ways his farewell address to the party. So it was pretty moving.
Indeed. I to your point about the question here before America, it seems that the mission of most of the speakers this week would be to crack that shell of mistrust that so many Americans seem to have about Hillary Clinton. Never mind the liking or not liking, because we don't have to like our president, but we do have to trust our president. Did these speakers succeed in your view?
I think to a great extent, yes. And of course, much of that is going to be up to Hillary during the campaign. You know, I know Hillary Clinton, and I trust Hillary Clinton. I think there's been a very serious concerted effort to try to discredit her. That's politics. It is really the function of these political parties, sometimes certainly the Republican Party, to try to demonize our candidate. But, you know, these elections, they are sort of determined on a number of fronts. Policy is one question, like what are the policies? Clearly, people can distinguish what Hillary's policies are. It's very difficult to figure out what Trump's policies are because he never articulates them. But the question of trust, you know, we hate to turn it on that, but the question of trust, if this race is based on the question of trust, all we have to do is just look at the record of the two candidates. We can't believe a word Donald Trump says. I mean, he is almost pathological in his willingness to distort and actually pretend that he didn't say things that are still echoing in the room that he's speaking in. It's almost inconceivable that he could be a legitimate candidate for president.
But do you worry that he could be elected? Do you believe he's got a real chance?
I think, you know, we cannot take anything for granted. It more than likely will be a close race. I think we have to certainly it's a very close race. I think it is. If he is competitive, it's because he is appealing to the worst nature, to the fears of people, to their anger. We understand those fears and we understand that anger, but we think Hillary Clinton does, the Democrats do, that we are called to the offices we hold, not to pander to the worst instincts in people, but to try to elevate people to get beyond their fear, to get beyond their anger, and to try to create a path forward. That is what we have to do in the next few months. That's what I've been trying to do my whole life, and I think Hillary will be able to do it. So I do have some concern, but I think we can overcome it.
Congressman, we saw Wednesday had Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan and Flint Mayor Karen Weaver at the podium speaking to the convention. Why do you think Michigan got more attention at the Democratic convention than at the GOP convention?
Well, that's a good question. I think in many ways, because the policies of the Democratic Party align with the people of Michigan, and it would be very difficult, I would suppose, for Michigan to have played a central role in the Republican convention when their nominee suggested that auto workers and auto jobs should be shifted to Mexico so that they can lower the wages and then maybe have those jobs start up again with much lower wages, or a nominee who would suggest that General Motors should have gone bankrupt. So I think they would have had a very difficult time focusing much attention on Michigan when it's so clear that the policies of Donald Trump, to the extent that we can figure out what they are, have not really been aligned with the deeds and interests of the people of Michigan.
Congressman, I cannot let you go without noting that it certainly has been a very, very big week for you to meet and talk with Michigan's Democrats from, you know, people from all over the state. Your name is being mentioned more frequently in connection with a possible run for governor in 2 years. I'm wondering, what are you hearing from delegates this week who would clearly like to see a Democrat get in the governor's office? I'm wondering how much food for thought this week has given you.
Well, I've certainly had a lot of people encourage me to think about it. And my answer has been that I will give it a lot more thought when the time comes. My focus is right now on 2016, the 2018 election, you know. While it seems like it's a long ways away, I guess it's not that far. When the time comes, I'll give it a thought. But the other point that I make to folks is I'm not interested in running for any office, just to hold office. All of this is about trying to grow our economy, create greater opportunity. If I feel like in a year or so that there are enough people in Michigan across the political spectrum that are ready to sign on to a big, bold agenda that has us betting on our future again, that will play very heavily in the decision as to whether or not I run for governor.
Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint from Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. Great talking with you, Congressman. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Attitudes about race have been improving in Southeast Michigan, but there are still wide gaps on some issues between white people and black people. Those are some of the findings in a new survey commissioned by the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Lester Graham with Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative has more on that.
The survey included people from mostly black communities, mixed communities, and mostly white communities in the Detroit metropolitan area. When asked to rank the importance of race relations in their lives, black and white people ranked it below issues such as education and crime. Bernie Porn is with the pollster Epic MRA. He says the poll was taken while news coverage was full of national stories about police shooting black people and police being shot by snipers. And with that backdrop, Porn says attitudes about race relations were fairly positive.
And over the course of a period of time, I think that things have become more race-friendly in Southeast Michigan.
Porn says the historic divide between white people and black people in the Detroit metro is changing. Older white and black residents tend to be farther apart on many issues, while younger people are closer.
Clearly, there has been an evolution of opinion and changing demographics.
He thinks part of the reason is more socialization between the races, especially in suburbs close to the city. However, black people and white people are far apart on a handful of important issues. One of the respondents, an African-American man who only gave his name as Lamar, says being black today still means discrimination.
When I go to my interest rates in terms of my borrowing, my mortgages, et cetera, all of those things. Also, I can't go shop in a mall without being profiled and followed as if I'm a thief.
He added, in Michigan, it's chiefly the black communities which are being taken over by state-appointed emergency managers. He also notes people in black cities are subjected to some of the nation's highest auto insurance rates.
We're still very much redlined. So by choosing to live in Detroit and not choosing to live in the suburbs, I have to pay what I call a black tax, where my insurance rates are astronomically high.
The survey revealed well more than half of the people of color say they are treated as suspect in retail stores, and they're treated as if they're not smart. But a researcher says those are things that only society can change. You can't pass a law or make public policy requiring white people to treat black people with respect. Joe T. Darden is a professor at Michigan State University. He says the most important findings in the survey are the black respondents' treatment in housing, loans, education, and voting.
Do whites believe that blacks are treated differently? And do blacks believe that blacks are treated differently?
And in many cases, this survey shows there are major differences. Despite research showing African Americans and Latino Americans are discriminated against by real estate agents, bankers, in employment opportunities, in the courts, and by police, many white people don't believe it.
Whites say things or think things that are just not consistent with the research. When they believe that blacks, for example, are treated the same when it comes to mortgage lending, if they believe that, it's just not true. And so, in a sense, that has to be corrected.
Darden says lawmakers and policymakers need to be better informed about these issues and make adjustments to ensure equal treatment of people of color.
Those are key because if blacks feel that they're not treated the same as whites, grievances emerge that may be potentially dangerous down the line. Okay?
Darden says that's exactly what happened in Detroit in 1967. While there is greater agreement between whites and blacks on many racial attitudes, there are still some huge gaps in how whites understand the experience of being black. With the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Up next, he's on a mission to give high schoolers in Detroit the tools they need to succeed in tech careers.
If you graduate from high school, I don't think you're qualified to do very much of anything right now, and I really want to change that.
And then in 10 minutes, the rise and fall of Ypsilanti car creator Preston Tucker. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
Over and over again, we've heard tech jobs in Michigan are going unfilled. There aren't enough students graduating with the tech know-how that employers want. And we hear students in Detroit just don't get many of the same opportunities as kids from other school districts. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea thinks he's hit on a way to help solve these problems, and it's all wrapped up in a school bus. Thomas Phillips is a graduate of Lawrence Technological University in Southfield. His next idea, the Aspire Tech Bus, something he calls High Tech Voke Tech. Thomas Phillips, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You want to bring the tech industry to Detroit students through this Aspire Tech Bus. What is a tech bus?
Tech bus is a concept I came up with a couple of years ago. I want to basically convert an old school bus into a tech lab where there are desks and workstations in the bus for students to come into. And I want to drive around to different locations in the city and teach web development or other advanced STEM programming concepts to kids in Detroit.
This is a genius idea because we know that there's nothing built more sturdily than a school bus, is it?
That's a good point.
Yeah, so you're good right there. So you're trying to give these kids the tools for college or also to maybe if they want to become entrepreneurs or get into work right away?
Right, because a while ago in Detroit, I know that high schools would prepare students for maybe jobs in factories or something like that when that was a very lucrative thing in Detroit. But now the industry and the landscape of the city and everything has changed. If you graduate from high school, I don't think you're qualified to do very much of anything right now, and I really want to change that. What I want to do is I want to prepare them to either go into one of three things. They can better be prepared for college by going through this program. They can possibly be recruited directly into a large tech company or join the entrepreneurial ranks where they can just start their own business. I want to give them the skills to go any of those three paths.
Now, I know you're still pulling this plan together and kind of coming up with what you think the curriculum should be, but give us an idea of just what you're thinking of, the kind of specific topics and work that you might be giving these high schoolers.
The first idea I have, this is a curriculum that I've developed already. It's two sessions of 16-week courses, so it'll be two full semesters. The first semester will be front-end web development, where I go over the basics of programming to kids who have a basic understanding of computers and web and the technologies, and I'll take that understanding and show them how to actually create a web page. So the first half will be web basics and programming basics, and the second half will be using back-end technologies. I'm looking at Node and the rest of the mean stack, so I want them to learn Mongo, Express, Angular, and Node.js.
And what does that mean for those of us who don't know what that means? What is it exactly that they'll be learning?
They'll learn how to build a website as well as how to host the website on a server. They'll learn how to build their own server on Raspberry Pi, which is a microprocessor built for students. That will be their workstation as well as the server which hosts their websites. At the end of the course, they'll have the skills to build a website from scratch. They'll be able to build a server from scratch, and they'll have the hardware on which their websites will be hosted.
That's pretty great. How many students are you thinking as you plan all of this? And I know it's still, you're trying to get it up and running. How many students are you thinking you might be able to reach in a given semester?
Well, right now I'm in the planning stages. I'm just planning around 8 to 10 students for this first incarnation. But as the program grows, then we're definitely be looking to scale.
And I guess that leads to the next question, paying for it all. Mm-hmm. Where might that money be coming from? Are you getting people on board to say, yes, I want to help out with dollars?
I actually just announced it to the world for the first time, maybe about a month ago now, at the Hack the CD Cultural Innovation Conference here in Seattle. I did a presentation, and I got a lot of support that weekend. A lot of people have mentioned that they would be willing to support financially as well as helping to develop some of the ideas. So, yeah, I'm getting all of my ducks in a row so that I can start my Kickstarter campaign soon. I want to have a video explaining my idea so that everyone who comes to the page can know exactly what's going on. And I just want to have as much information as I can to present to the Kickstarter audience.
You know, it's interesting. You just mentioned being in Seattle, and there's so much conversation, Thomas, in our state about the brain drain, about people graduating from universities in Michigan and then going elsewhere. And you wound up moving to Seattle to work for Amazon after you graduated from Lawrence Tech. Are you prepared to come back to Detroit to run the program? Was that your plan?
Definitely. Yeah, my plan when I left Detroit was to do exactly this. I wanted to go out and get the skills that I needed so that I could bring them back to Detroit. I'm kind of like the LeBron James of tech, huh?
All right. I like that.
Coming back home.
Thomas, do you think Detroit is a good test lab for growing this concept and developing something that really could be taken to school districts all around the state?
I do, because the state of the DPS school system right now, it doesn't seem to be very good from the outside looking in. So I think this is fertile ground for something like this to thrive.
And the idea that there are other struggling school districts that I'm
exactly.
sure would love to kind of get this going if you can get it off the ground and start having more than one of the buses.
Right. And that's what I'm thinking, is that if this can be like a self-sustained program that doesn't drain on the resources of DPS, I really think it could take off.
Thomas Phillips is a graduate of Lawrence Technological University. He's now an engineer at Amazon, and he is developing the Aspire Tech Bus, a school bus that's modified into a mobile tech lab, bringing that tech industry and knowledge to Detroit Public School students. You can find out more by going to his website, aspiretechbus.com. Thomas Phillips, thank you so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
One of the most fascinating stories in America's business history. The car salesman from Ypsilanti who wanted to give a war-weary America a brand new car, a car of the future. But his dream was torpedoed by the Securities and Exchange Commission, which chased him down with accusations of fraud. That's the story of Preston Tucker. Writer Steve Leto explores the rise and fall of this fascinating entrepreneur in his newest book, Preston Tucker and His Battle to Build the Car of Tomorrow. Steve, it's good to see you again.
It's great to be here.
What made you want to dive in and tell Preston Tucker's story?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we've all heard the story if you're into cars, and they made a movie about Preston Tucker. Francis Ford Coppola made Preston Tucker the man in the dream.
Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
It was good.
It was a good movie, and a friend of mine who lives in Bloomfield Hills is a Tucker expert, and one day he said, you know, someone needs to write a book about Tucker, and I said, well, they made a movie. Isn't there already a book? And he said, there's never been a good, thorough biography of him written by somebody who wasn't attached to the story. And I thought, wow, you know, uncharted territory. So I did some investigation. Turns out he was right. So I talked to my publisher, and they said, yeah, write it and we'll publish it. So,
what hooked you about his story that made you decide you wanted to do this?
You know, I wasn't quite sure before I did my research whether the movie was accurate. In other words, was he really a guy who was shot down, or was he really a huckster who was trying to rip people off? And the more I dug into it, the more I came to believe that he actually was honestly trying to build a car. He was trying to start a car company, and he got shot down by government regulators, which, of course, is a story as old as government and as, you know, recent as the most recent headlines. And that's the scary part, is that he was basically put out of business, I believe, by vindictive bureaucrats. There were a couple bureaucrats in Washington who wanted him out of business for whatever reason. And so he tried to start the car company, and they put him out of business. And that, to me, is a scary concept in America.
All right, let's, before we dive into who they were and why they did that, let's kind of give everybody a refresher course on where America was at the end of World War II.
Yeah, during the war, the American government commandeered the auto industry and said, you guys can't build cars anymore. People don't need new cars. We need army tanks, airplanes,
jeeps,
bombs, jeeps, cannons, you name it.
B-17s, yes. B-24s, yeah.
And so they started cranking these things out. Everyone knows, you know, the arsenal of democracy. You know, the Chrysler was building army tanks for a couple of years. And so when the war ended, there was a car shortage in America. And people were clamoring for new cars. And everyone knew that if you just simply started cranking out cars, didn't matter how good they were, that they would sell. And so Preston Tucker said, wait a second. And he was a well-known car guy. He sold cars. He was he worked for a bunch of different car companies as a car salesman, as a regional manager, zone manager. He could sell anything to anybody.
So he was a seller, not an engineer.
He was a seller, exactly. But he was a bit of a car aficionado. Mm-hmm. And he knew more about cars than a lot of other salespeople might. But he said, you know, this is a golden opportunity. I could start a car company. And because I don't have these legacy problems, I can do anything I want.
Clean slate.
There you go. Yeah. And so he says, I'm going to build a car. It's going to be rear engine, rear wheel drive. It's going to be lower to the ground, aerodynamic, safe. And it's going to have a bunch of new modern, you know, newfangled features that had just been developed. He's hoping to put, you know, fuel injection in it and disc brakes and things of that nature. And he also said the car will be safe. And nobody focused on safety before the war. Look at a car from the 1940s. It looks more like an army tank than a car.
The car I grew up in as a kid in the 50s.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so Preston Tucker, when he made this announcement, he knew enough people in the media that people jumped on his story, and he got a lot of attention. And he very quickly became a household name in the mid to late 40s. And there were a couple very important news items that appeared about him and his dream. They were talking about the fact, here's a guy, and we think he can do it. And so he wound up raising $20 million in the mid to late 40s. That's a lot of money.
Oh, yes.
And he actually secured the rights to a huge factory in Chicago. It was one of the largest, if not the largest, building in the world, manufacturing facility. And he started building cars in Chicago based on his dream of building this futuristic dream car that people could afford.
And then...
Well, and then
he presents the 1948 Tucker at his Chicago factory, right?
Yeah.
Summer '47.
Yeah, and he unveils this car, and they nicknamed it the Tin Goose, and it's a beautiful car, and there's some question about how roadworthy that prototype was, but he wanted to show people what it looked like. So they present this car, and then they do the stock offering, they raise the money, and everybody's all gung-ho about we're going to be building cars. And some people in Washington, for some reason, and we don't know who, but people in Washington, like Harry McDonald, who was at the Securities and Exchange Commission, start investigating Tucker.
Like they smelled something.
Well, they claim they thought they did. But the Securities and Exchange Commission, at the time, their only job was to oversee stock offerings. And they had approved Tucker's stock offering. And they then later said, well, we decided to go back and revisit it. And they never explained quite what their motivation was. And they started investigating, and someone leaked to the press, and we think it was the SEC, that they were investigating Tucker, and they were going to prove that he was committing fraud.
Wow.
And they leaked that to the press before they'd finished their investigation. So that there was a headline in the Detroit News, for instance, Tucker accused of fraud in gigantic letters. I think the only time they used bigger letters was when Nixon resigned, okay? And that headline put Tucker out of business almost immediately. The stock crashed. People wouldn't give him credit. Suppliers wouldn't send him stuff. His vendors wouldn't work with him. People were panic selling the stock. And, I mean, he was put out of business almost overnight.
Like letting the air out of a balloon.
Yes. And so then the federal government announced, we're going to prosecute Tucker for the fraud. And so they put Preston Tucker and his board of directors on trial in Chicago. And the trial dragged on for several months. And that's really when the company got shuttered. I mean, he tried to keep building cars. They did build 51 cars before they were done. But when they put him on trial, it was an interesting exercise. I'm an attorney, and I was reading these transcripts, and I'm going, this is such a strange case, because even during the trial, the judge would stop the prosecutors and go, excuse me, this man's on trial for breaking laws. He's not on trial for building a bad car. And they would bring in engineers to talk about how good the car was, whether the car was well designed, whether the car would actually do what Tucker had promised. And the judge even said, it sounds like you guys are prosecuting him for simply not building a good car. And at the end of the prosecution's case, when the prosecution rested, the defense stood up and said, you know, there's nothing to defend here. And they actually waived putting on a defense. They went straight to the jury, and the jury came back not guilty on all counts as to all defendants.
What a slapdown of the case.
Yes, but unfortunately, Tucker was out of business at this point, and he couldn't recover from that point.
Is there a sense that the SEC's campaign was fueled by perhaps jealous competitors?
Well, Preston Tucker went to his grave believing that the big three had pushed the SEC to do this. And the head of the SEC is a guy named Harry McDonald. Harry McDonald's an interesting character. They called him the singing milkman, for instance, because he started in the business with a dairy business in Detroit. And he'd often break out into song at strange places. But he was also at one point in time the head of the Detroit Stock Exchange. And, of course, the big players in the Detroit Stock Exchange were Ford, GM, and Chrysler. He had friends in high places. And Tucker claims that he talked to McDonald without any of the witnesses around, and McDonald told him, I'm getting pressure from the big three.
Mm.
I don't know if we can take that to the bank or not, but I certainly think that McDonald knew where his bread was buttered.
But at one point in your book, and I'll read the quote, Tucker was unrealistic about the difficulty of mass-producing automobiles, particularly at the price point that he promised consumers. So was there any merit to the SEC's sense that there was flim-flammery?
Well, that's the question, is whether Tucker knew he couldn't build the cars or if he hoped he could build the cars. And he was an optimist. He was everyone I talked to, you know, grandchildren. I talked to children. I talked to, you know, descendants of his. And they all told me that he was a salesman, but the people who knew him best knew him as an optimist. He believed that everything was going to work out, and it almost always had for him. He had had some amazingly, you know, lucky things happen to him in his life, you know. And so he, I think, honestly believed he could build the cars. Now, he hired a bunch of people to work with him who probably told him, hey, we're going to have a hard time meeting your price point or getting the car to do what you want it to do. But if you look at the original prototype and then how it developed into the production cars, he did make changes and he did listen to the experts. And so he hired experts who, we don't know, but I like to think if he'd been given the time, he could have worked out a lot of these problems.
And he didn't live long after, did he?
No, he actually tried to start another car company afterwards. He moved back to Ypsilanti, and unfortunately he contracted lung cancer, which at that point in time was a veritable death sentence, like just how much time do you have left?
What do you hope people get out of reading your book, Preston Tucker?
Well, I think it's an interesting story of just Americana. I mean, here's a guy who tried to start a car company, and he actually got further than most people remember. I mean, there are 47 of these cars still on the road today.
And what are they worth if you were to try to buy one today?
One of them sold recently for $2.9 million. We know where all 47 of the survivors are. If you could actually find one that's been destroyed, they'd actually take it and repair it, and it would be still worth a lot of money. And so I like to think that it's an interesting story of Americana, but also I think there's a lesson to be learned here, because I do think it was vindictive bureaucrats who went after him. They weren't doing their jobs. Harry McDonnell later said, well, I was protecting stockholders. Well, what he did caused stockholders to lose all their value. Okay, he did the opposite of protecting stockholders. And so I worry about what happens when someone in government gets a little bit too energetic in what they're trying to do and whether they're staying inside the bounds of what their job is.
I have to say, I really love the point. Props to you for getting Jay Leno to write the foreword. We know a notable car lover. But I love what he wrote. Preston Tucker's legacy is that of the ultimate underdog, the everyman whose optimism would allow him to triumph against great odds. Fascinating book, Preston Tucker and His Battle to Build the Car of Tomorrow. Author Steve Leto will be signing his book at the Gilmore Car Museum near Kalamazoo this Saturday, July 30th. Steve, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your book with us here on Stateside.
You're welcome.
If you're just tuning in and you missed part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast to find the link. Up next, a look at what's going on with the Regional Transit Authority that hopes to expand public transportation in Southeast Michigan. And then a Detroit writer moves to Ann Arbor and gets a shock about her car insurance. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's no secret that the mass transit picture in Southeast Michigan is pretty much beyond dismal. A staggering 92% of jobs in Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw counties are not reachable by public transportation. A $4.6 billion 20-year plan to expand public transportation would address this problem. It would set up the RTA, the Regional Transit Authority. But trouble is looming for this latest of many attempts to launch a viable regional transit system. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now. And Daniel, I think a lot of people thought that this RTA, which has been in the works since 2012, was humming along, was happening. So tell us what's going on now and why is it threatened?
Well, you've got the same counties that are always raising questions about these kind of regional things, raising questions at the last minute. Oakland County and Macomb County are saying, oh, wait a minute. We feel like the breakdown for the money isn't fair. We don't think the governance structure is right. Essentially, it would create a situation where Detroit and Wayne County could gang up on the other counties and essentially push something through even if they didn't like it. So they're saying, we're not prepared to vote on this, and if we vote on it, you're going to lose, and we're not going to be able to get this thing done. It's very important for them to get this done by the middle of August, I think August 16th to be precise, so county officials in each county can sign off on the ballot language that's going to go on the November ballot.
Because that's the whole point. This has to go before the voters and let the voters say yay or nay.
Right. And, you know, part of my argument, and I think the argument of some of the business and civic leaders, is we got to let people vote on this. This is, I think, very indicative and is going to be a test of how much of this newfound cohesion we had coming out of the Detroit bankruptcy, what kind of staying power it has. I mean, you've got the same people involved. You've got the same people at the table. And we haven't had, you know, electoral changes in these communities or big changes in the business leadership or in the civic leadership. It's all the same people who not too long ago were singing, you know, we're all working together. It's regional. We get it. We've learned our lesson. I think this is going to be a real test.
Well, and as you note in your column, we have not just the bankruptcy. Seen that regional cooperation, the Cobo Center. We saw Detroit Water merge with the seven counties to create the Great Lakes Water Authority. But here we have Oakland County Exec Al Brooks Patterson and Macomb County Exec Mark Hackle, you know, throwing this clangor in. And it is as 11th hour as it could get, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's the frustration that people who are pushing this really have is that, you know, we're very close to this and all of a sudden there are issues. And, you know, I think there's a feeling that there are bureaucrats behind the scenes who are pushing their own agendas here, people who run maybe some of the bus systems, whether it's DDOT or SMART or whatever. And there's probably some truth to that. On the other hand, you know, and I've said this in other contexts, Brooks Patterson and Mark Hackle are elected to represent their constituencies in their respective counties. They're not elected to represent the region. And so they do have a balancing act here, as does Mike Duggan or Warren Evans in Wayne County. They all have a responsibility to their taxpayers. And so they do have to weigh these issues. And I interviewed Mark yesterday, and I think his concern is if this thing is to go ahead as planned, he feels very, very confident that Macomb County will vote against it and vote it down. And then I asked him the obvious question. I said, is this your gut feel talking to your peeps and your contacts around the county, or have you done polling? And he said, no, we haven't done polling. My concern is this is the, kind of his personal read. That said, there are people who are involved in this who have already done some polling, and they do believe that it would pass in Macomb County as it would in other counties. So that all kind of remains to be seen as they move forward.
And how much heavy lifting would it take to kind of change what's taken 4 years to construct in order to satisfy their objections, get them to say yes, and get it on the November ballot?
My sense is, based upon what I've heard and what I've and the people I've talked to, is that it really comes down to governance, to make sure that everybody has an equal voice here and that you can't be ganged up on and iced out, and also on the revenue. As I understand it, about 85% of the revenue generated in each county by the millages has to stay in the county. So somebody like Mark Hackle has a concern that as his county grows, and it is growing, it's one of the faster growing counties in the region, is he going to continue to get that money? So is he going to continue to get that 85, 85, 85, or is it whatever, is it 85% of in 2017, that's going to be the same dollar number that they're going to get in, say, 2020 or 2022?
Basic stuff. You would think they would have kind of, you know, spoken up before before the bell's about to toll whether or not it can get on the ballot.
But this is very emblematic of how things get done here. And, you know, they're both pointing to what was done with the Cobo Authority. And the Cobo Authority, by the way, is a fabulous example of regional cooperation. You know, it had been a city department for a very long time. Finally, a regional authority takes over. They've done a $300 million or so renovation of Cobo expansion. They did it ahead of schedule and a little bit under budget, and they've done it without a lot of problems and a lot of finger pointing. So there are examples here, and that I think that was the example when we were looking at the water thing, was, you know, you can do it here and it can be done. But the other thing we have to remember, this is an election year. Mark Hackle is being mentioned as somebody who might run for the Democratic nomination for governor in 2018. You got to believe there's a little bit going on in the back of his mind here, although I will tell you that getting crossways with Mayor Mike Duggan is not a very smart political play if you're a Democrat, because he's probably the most powerful Democrat in the state right now and will continue to be if he continues to be mayor.
So just so we're all very clear, this vote is happening today and it has to be unanimous. It can't be by majority.
That's my understanding, although I think they're probably not going to have the vote, more than likely, because they know they don't have the votes that they need. I think they're going to try to have some additional negotiation. They've got a little bit of time to work on this, and I think they're going to try to take it, because I don't think it helps them to have a vote that doesn't succeed.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, as always, thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
And since we talked with Daniel, the late word has come in. The transit millage plan failed today's vote. The RTA board just could not get the votes it needed to okay the plan for the November ballot. Lester Graham will have more on this on tomorrow's Stateside. Now, consider this. You live in Detroit. You own a 2007 Ford Focus. You've never had to make an auto insurance claim. And then you get ready to move out of Detroit to Ann Arbor for a year. And that's when you learn your insurance is going to change by a staggering amount. That's what's happening to writer Anna Clark, who lit up Twitter with her observations about what she's experiencing, the disparity between her rates in Detroit and what she's going to be paying in Ann Arbor. Anna Clark, it's good to see you again.
I'm so glad to be here.
So set this up for us. You've lived in Detroit how long?
Since fall 2007.
And what are you paying to insure your 2007 Focus?
I'm paying a rate with AAA that amounts to about $203 per month.
And you're getting ready to move for a year to Ann Arbor. So you went and said, I'm moving to Ann Arbor. What's that going to do to your insurance?
Yes, I called the insurer and I let them know about my coming change of address. And they made a few quick calculations and told me that my rate was going to go down to $72.92 per month.
So that's like a 65% drop. What did you feel when you heard that?
You'd think I might be delighted that I suddenly have this much extra money per month that I'm not paying on insurance for the next year. But I was actually horrified. I'm aware that being a Detroiter, I pay higher car insurance rates than pretty much anyone in the country, really. But I hadn't, you know, really tuned into exactly what a premium I was paying until I had, for the first time ever, this direct comparison between the rates in Detroit and the rates in Ann Arbor.
And you write in your tweets and in your Facebook post and on Deadline Detroit, this should be illegal. It is certainly immoral. And speaking of that, you say you were actually encouraged to commit insurance fraud?
by numerous people. When I moved to Detroit, I bought my first car, this 2007 Ford Focus. I didn't own one before. So I was getting car insurance for the very first time, too. And I found out how much it was cost. It was much more than I was expecting. And the folks at the dealership where I bought the car, my first landlord where I was moving in, everybody was said, oh, just use your parents' address who live in St. Joseph, Michigan, on the west side of the state. It was presented as the normal and rational thing to do. And in some ways, it was rational because it was much less expensive to do such a thing.
But it's illegal and immoral.
It is illegal and immoral.
So you didn't do it.
I didn't do it. And plus, it has democratic consequences. I'm moving to Detroit. I want to vote in Detroit. I want to be a citizen in Detroit. I want the not to just take what's wonderful about living in the city, but also carry some of the responsibility that comes with it. But this, in the case of car insurance, it was just... it is ridiculous.
Well, now, your post on Deadline Detroit drew a lot of comments. Some of it heated, and some of the criticism coalesced around the argument that, hey, rates Detroiters pay are really high, but they reflect a higher incidence of car theft, carjacking, uninsured drivers. And you aren't an actuary, so there's no way for you to know what an immorally high rate would be. What are your thoughts on those comments?
Sure. I think I concede that it seems very rational given, you know, the greater vulnerability of owning a vehicle in Detroit with crime to pay more in Detroit and Ann Arbor. I think than Ann Arbor. I think the question is how much more makes sense. And I think that without having these formulas that the insurance companies are using, without them being transparent, I don't know. I'm just in this sort of trust them.
Trust them that Detroit is 65% worse and
right.
more risky than Ann Arbor.
Right. And we do know, of course, that the insurers also use more than just crime statistics to make these formulas. There's
credit
also
scores.
Gender, age, credit scores. As I've learned in doing more research on this, your occupation, whether or not you have a college degree, a number of factors that make this a pretty murky number that they're putting out there. And I think that it ends up penalizing people in this, like, you know, really, you know, a way that makes it difficult for citizens to really understand what's happening and why.
And we know Mayor Mike Duggan has proposed that so-called de-insurance plan that would kind of let Detroit drivers opt out of Michigan's mandatory and limited personal injury health care policies, the ones that auto insurers must pay under our no-fault system. But that plan is so mired in the state legislature, he hasn't even been able to get the Detroit delegation to unite on it. I guess you did end your post with a plea. Everyone, please say yes to the Regional Transit Authority, the RTA, if it gets on the November ballot.
Right. I think that part of the tragedy here is I think that if you're living in Detroit, you really just don't have that many choices for how to get around. Mm-hmm. Without regional transit, a truly, you know, robust, functional regional transit system, you almost have no choice in the matter of like needing to rely on a car. And with the kind of rates that the insurers are charging Detroiters, it basically like sets people up to either drive without insurance, which is, of course, a problem, to commit insurance problem, which is rampant. Both of those things, I think, you know, have a really circular effect, making the risk seem higher so that those who are paying more. And it's just such a tangle. And I think like without leadership from the insurers, from the insurance regulators, from public officials, I really don't see how we can change this. But we must, because it really is a disincentive for people to live in the city, to invest in the city, to be properly insured and be responsible citizens.
Because in essence, it is a form of taxation.
Absolutely.
Does this make you think at all, even a little bit differently about moving back to Detroit when you're done your year in Ann Arbor?
I want to be in Detroit. I love Detroit, and it's a place that feels home to me. I'm looking forward to my year in Arbor. I think it's going to be fabulous, but I do want to live in the city. I do look forward to the conversation with my car insurance agency when I do change my address back to Detroit, and I ask them to justify the higher rate that's coming. But I think where I feel most inspired right now is to talk about it more, to compare notes more, to write about it more as a reporter, because this is such a, you know, I think part of the reaction, I was a little surprised at some of the reaction to this on social media and Deadline stuff, but I think part of the reason it got so much attention is it's something that like just affects so many people, you know, like really puts people in a bind. People have seen it themselves, you know, other people have been sharing their stories. It's not just Detroit, of course, other major cities across the country, folks have seen the same thing. And I think, you know, a lot of folks are saying, well, this is how it's always been. We always do it this way. I think that distorts our sense of what should be normal, what's rational. And I just would like to see more transparency around the rates we're paying, because it has real consequences for people.
Anna Clark, you can weigh in on this by following her on Twitter, on Facebook, or she also has this posted on DeadlineDetroit.com. Always great talking with you, Anna. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
What is the most number of push-ups that you have ever done? Well, no matter what your answer, I'm going to guarantee you are not going to top Brett Masserant of Utica. Brett, while I was sleeping really, really late last Sunday morning, tell everybody what you were doing.
Well, I was probably breaking the record for most push-ups in an hour and most push-ups in 8 hours.
That is unbelievable. All right, tell us, how many push-ups did you do? First of all, the first record, how many in the 1 hour?
The first hour started off, we did 2,268.
And then you continued and you went a total of 8 hours for a total of how many push-ups?
13,186.
Okay, why?
Push-ups are definitely, in my opinion, one of the best exercises you can do. My dad, who's no longer with us, had a neuromuscular disease similar to Huntington's and was bedbound. And so I spent a lot of time by his bedside watching over him. So one of the things that I found to pass the time, I said, well, what can I do while I'm watching him in his room? I guess I can do push-ups. So I decided to do that. And so I said, well, how many can I do in an hour? Okay, 1,000. Can I do 1,200? Can I do 1,500? Can I do 2,000? And then when I started getting up around those higher numbers, I said, well, what's the whole record in the world? And can I try and beat that? So it's something that over the years has developed into something I want to try and accomplish and was able to do somewhat successfully. I wanted to break the 12-hour record, and that's still out there.
So that's, I can tell, I can hear it in your voice. You're already thinking, I want to go for that 12-hour record.
That's my Everest.
Well, I have to ask, what is your mind and what is your body saying or screaming at you as you're motoring through over 13,000 push-ups, besides please stop?
That's pretty much all it is you know, the first hour, 2 hours, it's not very hard from what I've practiced and gotten used to. And as you can see, if you watch any of the clips, around the 4 or 5 hour mark, it's like the halfway point for someone in a marathon. They talk about hitting that wall. Your body just starts saying, yeah, you need to stop. Elbows and shoulders and your triceps and your chest all start saying, yeah, we're not going to do this anymore. So it's good to have something to keep your mind off of it. So I watched a lot of TV during that.
Did you really? You had the TV on just to try to kind of distract yourself?
Yeah. I was watching the first season of The Sopranos, and I could only watch about 30% of the screen. The other 70% of the time I was either doing a push-up or watching the timer, but it's enough of a distraction, and there was enough people throughout the day that they kept me occupied where I said I could probably do 9 hours, not sure about 12, but I had enough support where 8 hours was a piece of cake.
Afterwards, what'd you feel like? I mean, were you even able to pick up a pencil?
It was definitely interesting. Right when I finished, the adrenaline was still there. And for about 30 or 40 minutes, I felt great. And I was like, well, this is cool. I should have just kept going. And then right when I got home, I was like, yeah, I did not feel well at all. And I ended up sitting on my stairs for about 2 hours. And I just had 911 on speed dial, and I was like, oh, my right arm is starting to tingle, but it's not my left, so I guess I'm okay for now, and things like that. So during it, I didn't think too much, but when it ended, it all kind of hit me at once.
So you had a few days past doing all of these push-ups for 8 solid hours. How are you doing?
Good now. I've been practicing for weeks and weeks, and I've been doing push-ups now for years, and I've bounced back very quickly, and I'm really ready, as I mentioned, to do that 12-hour, and maybe next month I'll try and tackle that.
So you've got your eye on that. That's your Everest. And then how long, Brett, before you get verification you're in the Guinness Book of World Records?
I'm putting together all the documentation right now. You have to get affidavits and video and all that. I would assume sometime mid-next month I'll be on their website.
Brett Masserant of Utica, congratulations, setting world records with 8 solid hours of doing push-ups, 13,186 in 8 hours, and that was after he did 2,268 push-ups in 1 hour. You're a beast. We're in awe.
Thank you.
Brett, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer was Tony Brown. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.